sludging along for over a decade. What kept you in it?
It was a steady build. I have a love-hate relationship with Rolling Stone Mag. They're too busy covering Sabrina Carpenter.
Just sold your Dumble amps.
It's a lot of money sitting around. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
But when does that bother you? Is there some piece of vintage gear that might not be so expensive? There he is. How are you, Joe?
Doing great, man. How you doing?
Fantastic. Where are we playing tonight?
Charleston, South Carolina.
How's sound check? Everything good over there?
Everything's going great. Just as planned. We're literally almost at the halfway point. And, at this point, we all got our gig chops. So sound check is, it's just make sure everything works and, save it for 8 o'clock.
Unbelievable. Well, Joe, I appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Not a problem, man. Not a problem.
So I wanted to ask you, Joe, because I remember watching the original Albert Hall performance when I was a kid, probably 10, 11 years old. And it was crazy because...
Joe, how old I am then?
No, Joe, you still got it. But it was crazy because I was on my friend's couch watching it. And not only did it turn me on to you, but it also turned me on to Eric Clapton because it made me go... Yes, because it made me go, this guy is so important to this guy who seems to be at the top of his game that I need to go in and look at Eric Clapton. So it was hugely influential.
It was, I can never repay him the debt of gratitude that I have because it was really, he gave me his stamp of approval. And, I always say that's always going to be my best DVD. It doesn't matter how many piece orchestra we put at the Hollywood Bowl. It's literally, you could not, it was like a fairy tale moment that wasn't scripted. It just, you literally just saw the look on my face going, I cannot believe I pulled this off. And it was legit,
The thing to me that blows my mind though about that is how relatively long it took for your career to really take off. Cause you were 32 when you were shooting that. And I think you were sludging along for almost over a decade. How did you not quit and go, what am I doing with my life? What kept you in it?
Well, here's the thing. It was a steady build. It was never an explosion. And you have to remember that the Albert Hall DVD was done for our purposes just to document the moment. And it was already released when PBS picked it up. So when PBS picked it up and started doing those hour pledge drives, that's when it went boom. And that's when the work really began. And I always tell people, it's like when you can never put a sell-by date on your career. Because if I said to myself, I'm going to do this until I'm 30 and then reevaluate things, well, I was 4 days shy of my 32nd birthday at the Albert Hall. It's 31. And it was May 4th, 2009. It was born on May 8th. If I had just put a shelf life on it and said, well, I'm going to go play for somebody else or go to DeVry, it never would have happened. And, my records got better. Saw you're seeing the apparatus of touring behind me. And there's four of these damn buses. It's a horribly expensive hobby. But I was making better records because in 2005, I met a guy named Kevin Scherz, and he started producing my records, and he still produces my records to this day. He's done every single one of them in the last 20 years. And we have been, it's been really instrumental in the quality of the records went up. I became a better singer. I became more of an artist. And it was the right thing at the right time. And it was a little bit of luck, a lot of perseverance, and the world was ready for the guy in the suit. And I transitioned between like this long-haired kind of pudgy kid into the guy in the suit. And it was all done because you have to put an image with a sound. And I kind of stole the whole image from, looking at Muddy Waters and B.B. King and, T-Bone Walker in the 50s and 60s, and they were all in suits. And then Eric Clapton was wearing suits in the 80s and 90s. And I was like, well, maybe I can do that too, and I at least owe my audience the respect enough to dress better than they are at my shows. And I've always looked at it like that. And I lost a bunch of weight, and I lost 50 pounds and became that character. And it is a character. I play that character on stage. I'm not like that off stage. I say things on stage I would never say to anyone in a conversation, because it's the character. It's what people expect from that. And I'm, you know, but then I put him away at 10:10, and I put this hat and this Red Rock sweatshirt that I got 30% off last week. And that's it.
But when you met Kevin Shirley, he basically said to you, okay, you're a great player, but the songs suck and the band's got to go. That didn't piss you off? Or did you agree with him? Or did you think he was right and you knew he was right?
Kevin's big leap. And sometimes you have to accept things that you don't want to hear. And he was right. And I was doing pretty good. I had a tour bus, and I thought I was, you know, doing better than, you know, some of my peers in the genre, and we were building. But he goes, this isn't going to scale unless it becomes bigger, wider, with better songs and a better band, you know? And he was right. You know, nothing in this business pisses me off except ignorance and people assuming things that don't happen because of what they read online. But you have to be able to accept criticism. You can't just accept praise. And you got to be able to accept that and learn from that and grow. If you don't, then you're going to stagnate and there's your career. You've just framed your career.
Now you look at it and you've built such an incredible company that you run and control. But early on, when you were signed to label deals and you got out label deals and promoters wouldn't take you on to book shows, you had to book your own shows. Mm-hmm. Did you feel frustrated that you felt like, I'm trying to do this blues rock thing and maybe there isn't a place for it? Or maybe I don't fit in the music business? And in hindsight, I guess Probably. It worked to your advantage, but that wasn't super frustrating.
Well, for every locked door, there's an opportunity to walk around and enter in through the side. And if all I need is your work ethic and some ingenuity. Now, people look at our company now like it was some sort of evil genius. No, it was my manager, Roy, and I going that nobody's going to book us in the kind of rooms we want to play. Nobody's going to pay us the kind of money we need to make in order to build the show. And nobody's going to put the marketing dollars into this because it's not the new, fresh, hip thing. But then I would open up for B.B. King, and I would look and see if Pat Peter, like we're about to play to now, and I go, well, there's 2,000 people in Charleston, South Carolina. They're like, the blues. Where are they? Because at the time, they were not at my show. And then you would see Clapton come through town. He played the arena, and he's playing Hoochie Coochie Man and Layla. And you're like, okay, well, there's 10,000 people that like this kind of stuff. Where are they? They're not at my show. Let's go find them. And that was the beginning of a marketing campaign. And my manager, Roy Wiseman, doesn't get enough credit because he, I'm the traveling salesman. He's the brains behind the scenes in the marketing department, the merchandise, the marketing shows, buying ads, targeted ads. So you're not just throwing your money away. All of that we have pretty much perfected through 20 years of Four Walls. And so now the thought of doing shows that are not our own, it's almost like a foreign concept. What do you mean we're not promoting? You know? But this year we've gotten into doing more festivals, which for the first time in 35 years, now they're calling us. And, you know, and I always say to the, you know, we're always grateful for the gig and the phone call, but there's no first time discounts. You could have got the discount 20 years ago, but now you got to pay us because we've earned that right. And I don't, you know, I got 30 right now. I got 33 people out here. You know, 3 trucks, 4 buses, a lot of moving parts, and all of them get paid to support what I'm doing.
Isn't it such a gift to have someone like Roy, who's been by your back for 30 plus years, that knows the in and outs of your business, has built your business? Like, no management relationships last that long with artists.
Well, you know, Roy started when it was nothing and believed in it. It only takes one guy to believe in. And the most important person to believe in it, it's got to be yourself. If you don't believe in yourself, then how you expect a guy like Roy Wiseman to believe in you? So it was a united front. And Roy and I joke all the time, we're crazy, but we're the same kind of crazy. And we go out and we do these things and we do, you know, how many people do you know promote their own shows at Red Rocks? This guy, you know, and we promote worldwide, you know, it does not take a rocket scientist to rent the Mercedes-Benz Arena in Berlin. Okay. It does take a rocket scientist to market it and promote it properly. To put the ad dollars in. And sometimes, even on shows that we have a quick sellout, we still put the ad dollars into the market just to let people know we're coming. So it doesn't seem like we've disappeared. You know, it's the tree, the woods, then doesn't make a sound analogy. You know, you want to, got to shake the tree. You got to do that.
Do you feel like that's your biggest accomplishment in a way, is building your career and company the way you've built it, to have ownership over every element of it?
I mean, Andy DeFranco has been virtually, vertically integrated for a long time. I think our greatest accomplishment is the fact that during the pandemic, our foundation, our Keeping the Blues Alive Foundation, raised over $1.3 million for bands that were struggling and couldn't pay their bills. And we gave away somewhere $500 or $600, $1,500 packages to artists that needed money. That's the greatest thing. Been a part of this is just whatever.
And why would that Rolling Stone or no one wrote about that? Why did no one write about that?
Why would they?
But what do you mean?
Isn't that a great story? It's a great story. Here's the thing, and I know some people that I have a love hate relationship with Rolling Stone magazine. And I know some of the writers over there and a couple of my friends and stuff like that. I said, do me a favor. Let me run the gambit. So when I retire, I can say that Rolling Stone never put my name in your fucking magazine. At least give me the respect enough to run the gambit of my career where I can actually say my name has never appeared in the magazine. And don't acknowledge it. Don't acknowledge anything that we do for charity. Don't acknowledge. I don't do charity to be thanked. I do charity and philanthropy behind the scenes more than anybody even knows, because that's what I do. And that's what I like. I'd rather give than receive. But, you know, when they could have written something to help us raise money, because we were giving away money to bluegrass bands, metal bands, hip hop. It doesn't matter. If you had gigs canceled, you got a check. You know, and it would have helped us raise money. But at the end of the day, they're not the only ones with a bully pulpit and a soapbox. So do I. And, you know, I mean, an Instagram post and a Facebook post, hey, this is what we're doing, I'd be better than any Rolling Stone article. You know, they're too busy covering Sabrina Carpenter. You know, she changes her shoes and it's like a 500-word article on it, and that's fine, and that's what they become. They become less influential to real music people, because it used to be like you made it in Rolling Stone, man, it's fantastic. I mean, like you're getting validation from the quote unquote expert. Now, yeah.
Wait, you've never been in Rolling Stone one time? You have to have been mentioned at some point in Rolling Stone.
Look it up. Never been mentioned in the magazine ever.
That would drive me crazy.
Listen, Zach, I wake up every morning the luckiest guy in the world. I'm a kid from upstate New York who grew up lower middle class, who played guitar from the age of four. I drive around the country. I travel the world. I play music to big venues and packed houses. What do I have to complain about? And for some reason, Rolling Stone doesn't rate me. If you think that that's going to make me cry myself to sleep tonight, I got a bridge to sell. You know, why would I care? Why do I care? It never would have helped. It didn't help. They've never reviewed an album. They don't care. They don't rate. And that's totally fine. It's totally fine by me.
I wanted to ask you, I was watching the performance of you at the Hollywood Bowl with the 40-piece orchestra. Amazing performance. What were those clear amps you had behind you?
Hurt myself. Those were a good idea that didn't sound very good.
And what was this?
My rig was off stage for the orchestra. So the whole rig was pushed off stage. So to have something on there that resembled a guitar amp, about 5 years ago, Fender and I built these acrylic Tweed Twins, the only two in the world. They weigh about 200 pounds. And they don't sound very good, but if you stick a LED in the back, they light up in weird colors. They're very cool. I've never used them on stage. And I said, here's the opportunity. Hollywood Bowl, let's get the acrylic twins out. And they were just for show.
Yeah. Oh, so there was no sound coming out of them.
No, the orchestra don't like guitars, especially loud ones.
They looked great. I heard you say in an interview from 2016, that at one point in this interview, you had said that you had just sold your Dumble amps and that they weren't working for you. And now you're obviously playing Dumble amps. You've got a lot of them. Why did you sell them in 2016? Why did they not work for you then? And what brought you back to them where now, you know, you're playing them all the time?
I got out of the whole, I got into like just straight into the Tweeds for a long time after the Three Kings. And I got tired of trying to go around and around and using too complicated of a rig to not achieve the same, to achieve the same result as plugging straight in. 2020 rolls around and I repurchased a couple at that point. And 2020 rolls around and I built this three-piece rig for when we're going to go about and do those shows that could only have 25% of the people, and we were just doing Power Trio. And I brought back the old amp shanty from years ago, and I plugged them all in. Same wiring, same pedal board, same everything. And I said, man, I've been missing the boat. So they're back. And now I have eight of them, which is too much for anybody.
But why didn't you like them in 2016? Because you were just playing the Tweeds and you were just into the Tweed thing you just weren't vibing with them?
A lot of money sitting around.
When does that bother you? Because you have a lot of money wrapped up in a lot of gear.
I know, but you know, I probably sold them in 2016 because I was funding Flying Bees or Sunburst Les Pauls. It's an expensive hop. And I got a couple of stupid offers on these things, and I just was like, I'm dumb not to take it. But now they're twice as much as they were when I sold the original bag. You know, it's just collectors do weird things.
So then when did you get back into them, or what was the one what was the first one that you got back after?
The Liskin, the one that's on stage now. There's three on stage now. But the Liskin combo. I was like, yes, this is real deal. And then I got a second one, and then escalates. And then the crown jewel of them all is the Lowell George. That one came to me after a 15-year search, or I knew where it was if this guy wasn't ready to sell it. And I lost out on that in 2011, and it came to me this year, and no regrets. It's a pretty special piece of rock and roll history.
What's been making you play Bender Telecasters lately? I feel like you've got a 68 that you've been playing, and you had on a couple songs like Time Clocks, which I love that Bender part.
I was just trying to write stuff like Jimmy Page did in the 70s. And I have this killer Bender Kelly with a old Parsons White, and it's like, it just works, you know? But, you know, the thing about a B-Bender is, like, especially if you think you get fancy with that, you can clam so hard because you're one step away from, like, oops, shouldn't have done that, you know? It's only a half step.
But you got the Bender, and then you said, I got to write something with this, and that's how you wrote the song Time Clocks with that Bender, that great Bender part in the verse.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was, I wrote it on that guitar. And it's just a cool guitar to have as a studio tool. And I used it live, too. I used it for a long time live.
Yeah, it's a great guitar. Joe, one of the things I want to ask you, I'm so curious about this. You talk a lot about using a 31-band EQ and just knowing where the frequencies are. I have no idea what this is. When I'm talking to sound guys, I'm like useless. So you've kind of inspired me here to get one to really understand this.
Well, you don't want to tell a sound guy it sounds whoopy or muddy or too.
That's me. That's where I'm at right now.
Because it's like, well, what is it? Is it 2K? Is it 5K? Is it 8K? Is it 250? Is it 100 hertz? What's rolling over? You know, why is the floor tom feeding back? Well, what is it? 350 hertz. Well, start there. You know, you just start realizing what each of those things do, and you can start talking intelligently and EQing your stuff more, you know, intelligently going, yeah, it needs a little air. Well, when you says air, when you say air to me, that's 5K and above. You know, 2K, 1.5, and 2K, 2.5, that's the spiky bits. That's why it's like, why does it feel like your guitar sounds, you know, like driving a spike through my face? Well, it's because it's too much 2K. You know, and once you just fiddle with it and know what it's going to do, your life gets a lot easier. And it doesn't take work with one for about an hour.
So what am I going to do? I'm going to get a 31-band EQ pedal, and I'm going to start moving. I'm going to set everything, what, zero? And I'm going to start dumping.
Set everything at zero.
Each one.
Move each of them up. By the way, forget 20 hertz. That's whales communicate like that. Okay? You want to start at about 63. An 80, that's your kick drum, you know, up to about 100 to 250, that's your bass guitar. 500 to about 5K, that's your guitar. Cymbals are 8K, you know, and you start realizing, it's like, why can't I hear my guitar when the drummer starts playing? So, because the snare drum's eating your lunch. Why can't I hear my guitar when the B3 starts playing? Well, the organ and the keyboards are right in your frequency band. So you need to, like, be around that. And so just take a guitar or a microphone and just see what each of those things does on an extreme, all the way up, all the way down. And it's great ear training.
And then from there, though, then you're going to take the EQ out of your rig, and then what are you going to do? You're going to try to find those frequencies with your pedals and with your amp knobs and try to recreate them. That's step two. Of really figuring out your
also
frequencies.
Also, understand what your amp's doing, what it's strong at, what it needs. You know, a tube screamer is a mid drive. All it is, it's high mids. You know, it's like, you know, that's what it does. It cuts the bass and pokes up about 650, 800 hertz and adds some gain. And you know, so when people talk about, like, I modified a tube screamer, I put the bass back in and more high end, it's like, well, it's not a tube screamer. It's a sonic distortion.
Right. Joe, everyone always talks about how you took lessons from Danny Gaddon. And I feel like even though Danny was the greatest player ever, you're up there too. I always have a hard time listening to Danny's playing and then hearing your playing or hearing the influence of it. What elements from his playing do you think rubbed off on your playing? Or was it just the fretboard and the skill and the knowledge of the guitar?
I don't know. I mean, I can sit down with you and grab a Telecaster, and you'll know exactly what he thought.
I've seen you do it, because you can shred on a Tele. I've seen you do it in videos.
It's just context. It's like the kind of stuff that I learned from him doesn't work in blues rock as much as the stuff I learned from classic. So it's context, you know? But he was the one that taught me how to speak. You got to speak all the languages. You know, you got to know a little bebop. You got to know a little straight jazz. You got to know blues. You got to know rock. You know, he taught me all the languages. And, but he also taught me how to drive a telly. And it's a different animal.
Okay. I know we're running out of time here. Is there some piece of vintage gear or something that if you want to buy something, you talk about Gibson amps are a great deal compared to Tweeds, or is there something that you could throw out to us to go on Reverb and buy that might not be so expensive that would be a really cool, really great piece of gear?
Lab Series L5, 212s of gear. Those things sound great. A Lab Series L5 from the 70s. I would also say a Stovetech MiG 50, which is basically a basement head. MiG 60s are good. You don't have to spend a lot of money. A PV Classic 30 gets you home. You know what I mean? It doesn't have to be bourgeois. I'm the king pork sniffer. I'm telling you that. You know, and I've seen Robin Ford play rented twins and sound like Robin Ford. You're gonna sound like you. You know, I've also seen him use the Dumbo, and it sounded amazing, but. He also sounds amazing through a rented twin. He's Robin Ford. And that's really the bottom line, you know? And my thing is don't read. Well, you can read, but don't take as gospel internet information written by people that don't have gigs play. Like in my experience, those are the loudest voices. And also the most uninformed, because the people that don't chime in are actually too busy gigging and figuring it out. And that's and there's no right and wrong. There's absolutely no right and wrong. You do whatever you want, however you want it, when you want it. That's the beauty of this whole. And it's all subjective. Some people love my tone. Some people think it's the worst thing ever. Okay. Wow. Again, These are outliers that I can't influence. And my best advice to anyone is just be yourself and don't listen to anybody if they're giving you unsolicited advice. And just be like, if you're happy with your sound, you're happy with your playing, and you're inspired, and you're making music, and you're playing, what more to life is there at this point?
Joe, that's a great answer. And some good gear to check out.
It's good. All right, Zach, I got to run.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
No problem, man. I'll talk to you soon.